Several years ago, when I preached, I shared this illustration with you. I will share it with you again. Many of you did not hear it then. I suppose maybe you could have heard it, but I just would like to, in capsule form, give you the life of Abraham Lincoln tonight as we begin. That is, concerning his persistence. Abraham Lincoln had a difficult childhood. He came up in far less than ideal circumstances. He had less than 1 year of formal schooling. He failed in business in 1831. He was defeated for the legislature in 1832. He again failed in business in 1833. He was elected to the legislature in 34. His fiancée died in 1835. He was defeated for speaker in 1838. Defeated for elector in 1840. He married in 1842, and his wife was a continual burden to him physically, for her physical condition throughout his entire life. Only one of his four sons lived past 18 years old. He was defeated for Congress in 1843, elected to Congress in 46, defeated for Congress again in 1848, defeated for Senate in 1855, defeated for Vice President in 1856, defeated again for Senate in 1858, and he was elected President in 1860. Not very many people would have made it to that point, would they? We never know what awaits us beyond our most recent failure, do we? Thomas Edison once said that rewarding toil calls for 2% inspiration and 98% perspiration. I would like to go out on a limb tonight and say that the Christian life and making a success of it calls for 1% knowledge and 99% persistence and application. Yes, we need to know a lot, and we ought to know the Word of God, and we ought to worship God because of it. But when it comes to just out there living, most of us know what we ought to do. We've heard the Word of God preached. We've been taught. We've read it. And basically, we know right from wrong and how we ought to live our life. It's just a matter of whether we're going to be persistent enough to carry it out. Are we going to persevere in the application of what we know? I looked up the word persistence in the dictionary this afternoon. It's very adequately defined as stubborn continuance. Just to continue on and be stubborn enough not to quit no matter what the life, what our life has to endure or what the world can throw at us. The difference between a Christian who lives the Christian life and does so victoriously and one who does not is simply persistence. We must persevere in the Christian life, and we must persevere in ministry. I'm not just talking about a preacher. We all are in the ministry. We all serve each other because we serve the Lord when we serve each other. That's how you serve the Lord. Persistence is an absolute necessity in Christian living and in Christian ministry. Gideon pictures for us a man of persistence. Gideon just had the tenacity of a bulldog. He just would not let Midian off the hook until he completely annihilated them, until he completely crushed them, no matter what it took, to chase them down and hunt them down and finish the job. We could only have the persistence in our life that Gideon displayed in his. That's what we need. We all need to be persistent. You see, because we all can find adequate excuse for giving up and quitting and falling short, we need to be persistent. Now, I'll take that simple truth tonight, and I want to just explain how we ought to exercise persistence in our life. Three ways I'm going to note here in chapter 8 from the life of Gideon. First of all, don't stop at the first obstacle you encounter. Then secondly, don't stop for lack of help along the way. And then finally, don't stop until you complete the task. We'll use that simple outline tonight. Now, I want you to notice, first of all, that Gideon did not stop at the first obstacle he encountered. Look at chapter 8, verse 4. And Gideon came to the Jordan and passed over. I like that. He didn't stop there, did he? He came to the Jordan and he passed over. He and the 300 men who were with him, faint yet pursuing. Now, in the original language, the Hebrew tends to give us the idea that what is said here is that he and his men were faint because of their pursuing. Now, it was several miles from the valley of Jezreel to the Jordan River. And friends, they didn't hop in the nearest ford and motor down there. And they'd been up all night, fighting all the way. And now they had arrived at the Jordan River. And just the natural thing for anyone to do would be to say, fellas, we done hightailed them out of here. You know, we chased them out. And they're across the Jordan now. I don't think they'll ever bother us again. Let's just sit down and rest. They were faint because of their battle and because of their pursuing of Midian. And when they came to the first logical obstacle, the Jordan River, and all that it symbolized, the most logical thing would have been to quit. Now, it only talks about Gideon and the 300. Where were the other guys out of the other tribes that came out, plus Ephraim? Where were they? I really don't know. Maybe they did quit at the first obstacle. Maybe they came to the Jordan, and they all just sat down and said, boy, we really did a great job, didn't we? Patted each other on the back, and there goes Midian and the Amalekites and their allies still with 15,000 men on the other side of the Jordan. But Gideon, when he came to the Jordan, he passed over. He said, boys, I know you're tired. You know, I know it's the fourth quarter and there's 2 minutes left in the game and you're tired, but we got to go on. And they went on. Remember when I went on vacation this summer, we stopped in Louisville, Kentucky, and went to a beautiful mall there, and Diane was shopping, and I was sitting, as I usually do when she shops, and just watching people and having a good time doing absolutely nothing. And along came a boy with one leg on crutches, very tall, sort of muscular type of fellow. And you know, you see handicapped people all the time, but seldom do you have time to sit and think and watch. And I just thought, my, what a struggle. And he just went on those crutches doing real good. And he came to the door, and I thought, wonder how in the world the guy's going to get through the door. I never thought about that. And, you know, I don't remember just exactly how he did it, but somehow he swung the door open and used the crutch, and he got through there. And I noticed he was carrying some things, and he hobbled on down a ways, and he found him a place, and he kind of sat down and leaned up against something in the center, and he began passing out flyers. I don't know what they were. I didn't go get one. But, gee whiz, he was busy doing something he felt was important. I don't know whether he was advertising something or promoting something. I don't know what he was doing. But most people wouldn't have been doing anything if they was in his shape. Most of us would use something like that as an excuse, and we can always find an excuse, can't we? Did you know that Thomas Edison was functionally deaf when he invented the phonograph? We can find an excuse anywhere, can't we? But excuses are simply that, they're excuses. I run onto some people that proceed to tell me how they're shut in and they're so bad off, and I know there's people sitting in my congregation on Sunday morning that's worse off than they are. It's not that they're too bad off to be here. They've just used that as an excuse. They've just encountered an obstacle. I know it's an obstacle. I know it might be hard, but they've allowed it to be an obstacle that stopped them dead in their tracks. It's your attitude that makes the difference when you encounter those obstacles. The story is told about two shoe salesmen that were sent to a South Pacific island. First day they were there, one man wired home, be back tomorrow, Nobody here wears shoes. The other man cabled back too. He said, send 10,000 pairs. Nobody here wears shoes. It depends on how you look at it. Our obstacles can often be the thing that, if we will just persevere and go on, will result in success. Abraham Lincoln could have stopped anywhere along the line. I can't imagine anybody getting defeated in that many elections. If I'd gotten defeated in about three, I think I would have hung it up and said, boys, you're not going to have me to kick around anymore. We never know what success lies beyond our current failure. Don't stop at the first chance. Don't quit at the first obstacle. And then secondly, don't stop for lack of help. Verse 5. And he said unto the men of Succoth, give, I pray you, loaves of bread unto the people who follow me, for they are faint, and I am pursuing after Zeba and Zalmunna, kings of Midian. And the princes of Succoth said, are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna now in thine hand, that we should give bread unto thine army? And Gideon said, therefore, when the Lord hath delivered Zeba and Zalmunna into my hand, then I will tear your flesh with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars. Now that's a threat, and it wasn't an idle one. He did do what he said he would do, as we'll find out in a couple weeks. Why was he so harsh? I'll tell you why he was, because that was high treason, my friends. He wasn't talking to just anybody. He was talking to Israelites. Talking to the tribes who had left, settled on that other side of the Jordan. And I said, well, guys, you know, we're not going to help you because Midian might come back and punish us. It was nothing short of treason. Succoth was the city that was in the tribal portion of Gad on the east bank of the Jordan River. They didn't even give their own brothers food to eat. And all, I mean, they didn't just stay home and leave their sword hanging up in the rack. They wouldn't even give Gideon's army a piece of bread. Now, most leaders right about that point would have said, fellas, I don't see how we can go on. I don't see how our strength can hold out. We don't even have food to eat. Not Gideon. Verse 8. And he went up from there to Penuel, and he spoke unto them likewise. And the men of Penuel answered him as the men of Succoth had answered him. And again, he's speaking to Israelites. And he spoke also unto the men of Penuel, saying, when I come again in peace, I'll break down this tower. Evidently, the men of Penuel had a fort, a castle, a tower that they used for fortification against the Midianites. And they thought they were quite safe, but they... You know, maybe the Midianites just passed them by, didn't pay them much mind, and just let them dwell in there and figured they were no threat. But if we help Gideon, they may come back on us. Gideon says, I'll take care of your tower. Again, treason. Again, nothing to eat. Twice he has tried to secure provisions for his troops and he gets nothing. Most people would have quit. Thought Gideon. He goes right on. But most of us stop if we don't get anyone to help us. It's just the way we are. If nobody will give us any help, if nobody will give us any encouragement, if nobody will stand with us, then, well, I'm not going to stick my neck out. Most things in life that are accomplished, that are worthwhile, are accomplished all by yourself. That's just the way it is. Really. Most things we do, nobody can help us to start with. Most battles in the Christian life that we fight, yeah, we could use some encouragement and so forth, but we still have to fight those battles ourselves. And many times when we could use some help, we don't get it. George Westinghouse years ago observed a train wreck. Two trains collided head on. Because of that, he proceeded to invent a brake that you relied on old, unreliable, and useless, many times, hand brakes. He began to perfect an invention, the air brake. when he tried to arrange to have his air brake tested, one railroad executive by the name of Commodore Vanderbilt replied to him, "Do you mean to tell me that you expect to stop a train with the wind?" He went on to say, "I don't have any time to waste on blankety-blank fools." Most people would have quit. Why spend my time trying to worry about this air brake, you know? Nobody's going to help me. No one's going to give me a break. Nobody's going to, you know, let me test it. Most of us would have quit right there. I'm just one man. Not so. George Westinghouse said, "Well, if they won't look at my air brake, I'll do something else." And he went out and he invented the railroad frog. Now, I don't know what a railroad frog is myself, but from reading the description of it, I think it's those things that stand on the track and cross, you know, and I don't know, whatever, some signaling device. But anyway, whatever it was, the railroad executives liked that idea. Some signaling device to help make the train safer. And it was because he didn't quit when he got no help with his air brake that he went on and he persevered and he invented the second thing. And it was because he invented that thing that later he got the chance to test his air brake. Pretty soon, all the trains were equipped with air brake because he was persistent. He didn't quit when he got no help. He went on. Don't stop at the first chance, at the first obstacle, and don't stop when you get no help. The lazy and the weary and the pessimistic, they quit when they run into that first obstacle. And many are the ones who get discouraged when they get no help. But we must go on. Then number three, don't stop until you complete the task. Gideon could have quit anywhere along the way, and everybody would have proclaimed Gideon a great warrior. And they would have celebrated a great victory, but the job wasn't done. Verse 10. Now Zeba and Zalmunna were in Karkor, and their host with them, about 15,000 men, all who were left of all the host of the children of the east, for there fell 120,000 men who drew sword. Now remember, there were 135,000 of the Midianites and their allies. There originally was 32,000. Israelites. 4-1 odds, and God cut that down to 300 at the onset of the battle, and the odds were 450-1, and Gideon went in. The victory was won. The other troops came back to help Midian, and Ephraim was called in and mopping up exercises, and they killed in the whole process. They either fell by the sword of Gideon and his men and the other Israelites, or they killed each other in the confusion as they ran that night. 120,000. Most people would have been well satisfied with that. We don't even have recorded for us in the Word of God that Gideon or Israel lost one man. Maybe they did, but there's really no indication that they lost even a single soldier. And 120,000 of the enemy lie dead. Most people would have said, "Boys, this pack are in. I mean, we're tired. We've, you know, 120,000 of them's already dead. We don't have nothing to eat. Let's just go home." The job wasn't done. It was 15,000 left. And there were two very prominent kings. You remember Oreb and Zeba were slain by the Ephraimites, but there's two more. Zeba and Zalmunna. Verse 11, "And Gideon went up by the way of them who dwelt in tents on the east of Nobah and Jogbeah, and he smote the host, for the host was secure." Now notice two things in verse 11. He went up by the way of them who dwell in tents. You know what that means? He just took the caravan route. That'd be like taking Interstate 79 when you're going to Charleston. He didn't bother to slip in the back way. He didn't bother to take the side route. Why? Because nobody expected to see Gideon coming over the hill. He already won the victory. They felt quite secure in their stronghold. They're described as being secure. That means they felt secure. They probably didn't even post a guard. Why, who ever heard of someone with the tenacity that Gideon had? I mean, to fight all night, to fight all day, have no provisions. Hey, the battle's over. Everybody's went home. So Gideon shows up, and the battle's on again. Verse 12, and when Zeba and Zalmunna fled, he pursued after them and took the two kings of Midian. Zeba and Zalmunna vanquished all the host. Now get this. The 300 men sneak up, or they don't sneak up, but they surprise the 15,000. And they're thrown into disarray and confusion, and they probably flee again, or at least they're defeated in battle. And in the whole thing, the two generals, Zeba and Zalmunna, slip out and flee. Now the battle's over. Surely we can quit now, Gideon. No, we got to finish the task. And off they go, pursuing Zeba and Zalmunna. Think they could have gave them guys a little better names than that, didn't they? He just wouldn't quit until the job was done, until the task was complete. Oh, for people with that kind of perseverance. It is said that Thomas Edison, in trying to invent the light bulb, tested countless thousands of materials to get the little filament that goes inside. Those little wire filaments, to find just the right thing that would glow and not melt and do the job. He sent people out into all over the world looking for different material. You know how small and slender, how little wire that filament is? It is said that when Thomas Edison tested a material and it would not work, that he threw it out his window. Before he invented the light bulb, those little filaments that he threw out the window were stacked in a pile that reached all the way to the second story. Can you imagine how many tests that was? How many experiments? How many filaments that would take? Why did he invent the light bulb? Because he was persistent. He just kept right at it until the job was done. He didn't care. I mean, I can just imagine Edison probably still been there if it was stacked up to the roof. He'd have been right out there working on it. Because he stayed with it until the task was complete. It is said that John Wesley, famous British preacher, founder of Methodism. By the way, you know why they were called Methodists? I wish they were still called Methodists for that reason. I'm afraid they're not, but originally, they were called Methodists because they were so rigid in their methods. They were just so much a stickler for detail, and they got up so early in the morning, and they followed a very strict discipline. That's where they got that name. It is said that John Wesley preached 40,000 sermons in his lifetime. He wrote over 400 books, and he knew 10 languages. At 83 years old, he was annoyed that he could not write for more than 15 hours a day without hurting his eyes. And at 86, he complained in his diary of an increasing tendency to sleep past 5:30 in the morning and of the fact that he couldn't preach more than 2 times a day. That's not 2 times a week, 2 times a day. He just kept after it until the job was done and the Lord called him home. My friends, if we're going to be successful as Christians, living for Christ, serving Christ, ministering to others, and thus serving the Lord, we must be persistent. We cannot stop at the first little obstacle that comes along. We cannot stop when no one steps forward to help us. And we dare not stop until our job is done. My friends, let me tell you this. Your job is done the day they put you in that grave. And it's not done before. A lot of people think they can retire from the Lord's service, and that's impossible. If you're still here and God's left you here, I guarantee you He's got a purpose for your being here. Will we be persistent? Life itself is a spiritual battle. And certainly so is the ministry, serving the Lord. It's just a battle some days. It's just a battle just to go on and face another day of life. The problems and the trials and the difficulties and the opposition that we encounter, we must be persistent. We never know what success lies just beyond that current failure. J.C. Penney, the son of a Baptist minister, lost his $9 million fortune almost overnight in the stock market crash of 1929. The trauma of that loss put him in the hospital. And there in that hospital, early one morning, he heard some singing. He got out of his bed and investigated. He discovered some of his employees gathered in the hospital chapel singing Christian hymns. He slipped in, sat down on the back row, and they sang, "Be not dismayed, whate'er betide, God will take care of you." J.C. Penney left that little singing service a new man. He regained his health and he rebuilt his chain of department stores across America into an enterprise far greater than the one that he had lost. He adopted the golden rule as his business ethic, and he gave much of his fortune to Christian causes. J.C. Penney learned an important lesson: persistence. Sticking to it. You can be like Penny, laid up in a hospital with life just burying you minute by minute, or you can ignore the circumstances and you can go on and you can persevere for the Lord. The choice is ours. I guarantee you that every last person sitting here tonight, somewhere along the road, is going to find themselves in a situation where they're going to consider just giving up. Why try? Why bother? Things are so bad and the difficulties are so great. I don't see how I can go on. And when you get in that situation, friends, you just need to go on anyway. You never know what lies beyond that present difficulty. The Christian life, maybe I'm exaggerating, but maybe not that much when I say it's 1% knowledge and 99% persistence in applying that knowledge. Some people know a lot and they never apply it. Some people don't know enough to apply anything. You need to be persistent. Life itself is a spiritual battle. And every one of us is in the ministry, and it certainly is a spiritual battle. Will you persevere, or will you be stopped by an obstacle, by lack of help, or will you just get tired and quit before the job is done?